has something changed in our politics to allow for more George Santoses? You know, yes, there are people who've lied, you know, even including recently Republican J.R. Majewski lied about being deployed to Afghanistan. Biden himself lied about his academic record in 88. There is a difference between what he's doing and the sort of run-of-the-mill lies that we've seen, which are bad.
Where the lack of accountability really is the fact that local journalism is dying. That resource in our country holding people on the local level accountable that's kind of withering away is allowing for situations like this to go by.
Welcome to The Last Debate, a show for Politically Eclectics. I'm Robbie Gupta.
And I'm Ricky Schlott.
Well, Ricky, happy 2023. How goes it out in California?
It's been cold and rainy and windy and miserable the entire time, which has kind of been a bummer. But I'm out here for the month, so I'm hoping that I'll get my share of good weather. But I imagine it's better than New York.
Yeah, what's cold in California?
Like 50 and windy and humid. So it's kind of, it's not as bad as New York. But, you know, I did come here thinking I'd have my LA January. And so far, it's been kind of a flop. It was pouring rain on New Year's Eve and unideal. But how's Costa Rica? I assume it's better than here.
Costa Rica is amazing. I mean, it's dry season here right now. It did pour yesterday, but it was great for me because I was back to work yesterday. So I was excited to see that I wasn't missing any of the wonderful weather. But it's interesting. This town, I've been coming here for a couple years now, and it's actually quieter during this time of year than it's been in previous years, which may be interesting to our audience because I think it's a story of tourism right now. Mm-hmm. The theories abound in town as to why there are fewer Americans and Europeans and Canadians than before, and some of them are obvious. Obviously, we're in the middle of a recession-ish. There's also flights are more expensive, and there's a lot of chaos around that. Remote work is less common, so people can't stay here and remote work like they've done in years past. And coronavirus and other flus and whatnot seem to be ravaging certain cities like New York City. Most of these are things we talked about on this podcast, interestingly. All of it adds up to me being able to surf the waves without a lot of people to contend with. So,
Although, no complaints for you. Although I feel like there weren't there like record-breaking amounts of people traveling for the holidays? Like there was a crazy airport meltdown.
I think a lot of that was domestic. I think people are visiting relatives more than ever, but not taking more extravagant trips like coming out here. Although, important to say, Jack Dorsey and Jay-Z have been milling about this area over the past few weeks. There have been all sorts of sightings. So, you know, just us Illuminati out here, Ricky, just hanging out. But I want to shout out again. Yeah, I want to shout out the folks at Outposts. It's a wonderful co-working space here. They've given me the recording studio for an entire month. And so that's where I am right now. And I've made myself home here. And so I'll be hopefully more at ease on this podcast over the next month. When do you head back to New York?
I think the end of this month. I'm trying to figure it out, but
So you're going to brave February in New York City?
I'm going to have to brave February because I can't be remote for too long with the New York Post. So that's the plan. But now we are back to our regular Tuesday, Thursday schedule finally. So back in the groove for all of our listeners.
Yes, and although we will handle an Elon voicemail later on in this episode, we promise our audience New Year's resolution, we will spend less time this year talking about him. We also have an episode of the Citizen Stewart Show dropping tonight, this afternoon, evening. We're going to talk about district corruption stories. We're going to talk about radical ideas to reform our K-12 system. I dust off the segment we used to do here on the Lost Debate Show and start talking about K-12 ideas. And we talk about technology in the classroom, and we do a kind of tour of all the new innovative technologies that are making their way into the classrooms. But today we have a pretty packed show here at The Lost Debate. We're going to talk about a controversial take on the so-called myth of home ownership. Then we're going to ask whether in the midst of the end of the snow day, but first, Congressman-elect George Santos is under fire.
Long Island Republican Congressman George Santos getting ready to be sworn in Congress tomorrow despite a series of lies on his resume.
Growing list of exaggerations and fabrications on his resume, including false claims about his education, his career, and even his mother's death.
Congressman-elect George Santos is now facing new scrutiny over his finances.
Records that his campaign filed with the FEC show 37 expenses that were just one penny below the threshold to keep receipts.
The latest investigation comes from all places, Brazil, concerning a years-old criminal charge, but it adds to the questions about his campaign and whether he'll be able to survive a series of probes now in progress.
So how do the people who voted for him feel about these developments?
I don't care if you're a Republican, a Democrat, if you're lying about such silliness as where you went to school, you need to resign.
I made a mistake. I think we can all look at ourselves in the mirror and admit that once in our life we made a mistake. I'm having to admit this in national television for the whole country to see.
So Ricky, he says he made a mistake. By my count, there seem to be many mistakes here. He's talked about being Jewish when he's not. He's lied about where he went to high school and college. He lied about working at Goldman Sachs, among other places. He lied about owning rental properties with tenants who didn't pay. He lied about his mom dying on 9/11. What am I missing here, Ricky?
Yeah, I mean, just to kind of ham all of those allegations up a little bit, he made specific claims that his grandparents fled Ukraine because they were Jewish and because of persecution. He's called himself a proud American Jew. Genealogy and investigators have found that he is from a Catholic Brazilian family. He's referred to himself as, in his defense, Jewish, which is very cringy, and something that he said to Tulsi Gabbard, who I believe on Tucker Carlson's program got the first exclusive interview with him, which was pretty difficult to watch.
We've got a letter that your campaign sent out earlier this year, which reads as follows. As a proud American Jew, I've been to Israel numerous times for educational, business, and leisurely trips. You said there in that letter that you are, quote, a proud American Jew. How do you explain that?
My heritage is Jewish. I've always identified as Jewish. I was raised a practicing Catholic. I think I've gone through this. Even I've not being raised a practicing Jew, I've always joked with friends and circles, even with in the campaign, I'd say, guys, I'm Jew-ish.
Marjorie Taylor Greene actually went after Tulsi Gabbard for this interview, said she was unfair to Santos and accused Gabbard of being partisan, which I'm not a big Gabbard fan, but accusing her of being partisan, I think she's... She at least deserves...
She deserves credit for
not being partisan. I wouldn't, of all the members of Congress, I would not accuse Tulsi Gabbard of being partisan.
Well, she also did, I think, a pretty good job of not letting up on him at all whatsoever. Like he, as you mentioned, he's fabricated a lot about his professional background and said that he's a seasoned Wall Street investor, said he worked for Citigroup and Goldman Sachs. There's no evidence from either company that he worked there. Records show that he was a customer service agent at a Dish Network call center in recent history. So quite different from the seasoned Wall Street investor he said he was. And he tried to pass it along on in this Gabbard interview as, oh, it's just like the American public doesn't really understand how the finance world works. And she didn't let him go on that one either, which was exceptionally bad.
Yeah, he does this move with Gabbard where he's like, look, I don't got time to explain to you lay people how deals work. Yeah. It's like, no, actually, we got plenty of time. Explain to us what's going on here, buddy. But yeah. But you sent me this article from The Hill, which actually goes into, you know, there's some things that make you laugh about this story. Obviously, it's serious because he's a member of Congress. And there's a whole scale of, you know, most people will say, well, all members of Congress lie. I do think this is a level of lying that we have not really seen.
This is a level that's just incredible. Yeah, just to tick through a few more before we even get to the campaign finance that I think are interesting. He reportedly obscured his marriage and divorce from a woman. He's an openly the first openly gay non-incumbent Republican to be elected. He said that he had 13 rental properties and was bitching and moaning basically about his tenants not paying him because of COVID. His fake tenants, because he actually lives with his sister Tiffany, and that is not the case. And he actually himself has been evicted 3 times. So he was a tenant that was not paying rent. He also tried to kind kind of link his mom's death, who reportedly she worked in the World Trade Center. He tried to link her death to 9/11. She died in 2016. He said he went to Horace Mann,
that's an insane lie.
That's, I mean, this, it just gets crazier and crazier, and the list goes on and on. And like the high school he went to, no records of him. He never went to or graduated from the college that he said he went to. And so it goes on and on and on. But I think, you know, those are all, as he says, embellishments of his resume. But I think what we're getting to here is that there are some serious financial potential lies in his campaign financing and his filings that might actually be the thing that gets him in the end.
This is a silly point, but as a former Democratic operative, it almost offends me as a professional that the Democrats didn't unearth this in the campaign.
Yeah.
Like, what are you doing?
Not to mention, local journalists have been talking about this for months, and no one was really paying attention to them, but yeah.
It's crazy. So, okay, you alluded to the campaign finance stuff, which is where this gets even more nefarious. There's a whole lot of money splashing around this campaign that he had. He provided his own campaign with a loan of $700,000, apparently from a $750,000 salary that he reported earning from this company that he has called DeVolder Organization. And we don't know a lot about what this company is. He uses a lot of buzzwords to describe what it did. There seems to be a lot of weird shenanigans going on in his FEC reports. One among them is that he had 37 expenditures for things like office supplies, hotels, ride-sharing apps, restaurants, et cetera, for the exact same amount, which is $199.99, which is notable because this is one penny below the dollar figure above which the FEC requires you to keep receipts. I'm not exactly sure what's going on there, but one of the allegations about at least the money he has and the loan that he gave to his campaign is that at least there's the possibility that people are raising that there's some kind of campaign finance violation possibility here, because there's individual limits. Like if I gave money to George Santos for Congress, I have, you know, I forget what it is, it used to be $2,600, but whatever it is, you have a limit you can give per person. But if you give money to your own campaign, you can give as much as you want. And so the question is that $700,000 coming from somebody other than him? We would need to know about his company. And obviously, we don't take anything he says about his own company and finances at face value.
Yeah. And his prior employer was accused of being a Ponzi scheme. He wasn't implicated in that. But the means by which he managed to jump from having no major assets to report in 2020 when he last ran from this seat to having $11.5 million worth of assets in 2022 is pretty questionable, to say the least. There are also allegations that his, like the things that he was doing to actually spend on this campaign, like he was hardly even taking out ads. Like, where is all this campaign financing even going in the end? Like, he was, according to local journalists, like there were barely any picket signs that he even, like lawn signs that he printed for his constituents. So where is he really spending this money? Why are there the same charges for the same amount? Like, that just seems pretty blatantly fake from the outside looking in. So there's now a federal probe into his finances. He's also being investigated by county officials, so both the national level and the local level. And if he did falsify federal forms, he could see up to 5 years of prison time. But by and large, in terms of his being sworn in today, seems like that's going to happen.
Yeah.
And that's probably happening pretty much as we speak right now. But long term, there may be a way to potentially remove him based on just how extensive these lies have been.
Yeah. My sense is you're not going to see, this is my prediction, you're not going to see him removed from Article 1, Section 5 of the Constitution, which basically empowers Congress to get rid of him with a 2/3 vote. I just think you're not going to get enough Republican votes there. McCarthy has not touched this. He's in the middle of his own attempt to shore up the speakership right now and appears to be at least 9 votes short as of this recording. My sense is he may very well cross that threshold even by the time this podcast airs, but he's got a very tenuous majority. And as part of his horse trading to keep his majority, he's weakening his own hold on the speakership. So when you've got some crazy going on in your caucus, like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who seems to be very defensive of Santos and is one of those 9 who's going to be one of the tough votes to keep, it's going to be really hard for McCarthy to hold Santos accountable. And he would have to be incentivized to do so. And we don't even have a head of the House Ethics committee right now, because you're going to have to wait for McCarthy to potentially win before he starts picking his leaders. So there's all sorts of things that need to happen here. There is some precedence here, but not a lot. It's really hard to remove somebody forcibly. Often what happens is people resign before there's an issue. So, you know, the history here, you know, we remember some of these, but my sense is this is as dramatic as an example as we've seen.
Yeah, I mean, 600 plus members of the House have resigned, but mostly because they've been elected to some other office. Only 6% resigned from scandals that were non-sexual in nature. So this sort of like deep-rooted ethics resignation would be very unprecedented. The House Ethics Committee could potentially just censor him or bar him from committees. But I like this proposal that Richie Torres came out with that is so cleverly named, the Santos Act, which stands for Stop Another Non-Truthful Office Seeker. It's pretty nicely done. Which would require a, like, under oath, if you're going to run for an office as high as his, that you disclose your employment, educational, and military history, because that tends to be most consistently where people do, as he says, embellish, perhaps not as much as he did. But that is, I mean, I have no issue with that whatsoever. I think if you're going to be elected by the American people, people are voting on your word and on your resume as you report it. Absolutely should be truthful. I have no problem with that whatsoever.
Yeah, and I served in the federal government and I had to get a background check to do that. And it's quite extensive. You have to not only give your entire employment history, they verify it. They go and interview people you've worked with and they examine your claims. They talk to your former roommates. They get your entire travel history so that they know, like, whether you've been traveling to foreign countries and, you know, and mixing it up with any people who may have any reason to, you know, capture me as a potential spy, you know, and whether, you know, they look at your finances to see if you're entangled with any foreign government or you're indebted in a way that could make you vulnerable to spies. These are all things that happen to rank and file employees in the government, especially people who are going for higher security clearances. Obviously, it's different in Congress because, like, they're elected by the people. They're not picked. And they're not interviewed and hired, but we should still create the transparency so the American public knows, all right, these people lied about, you might not be able to kick them out of office until the next election, but you should know whether people are lying about this kind of stuff.
Yeah. And at the very least, I think even if this doesn't become like a law, the American public can demand something like that. And it would be pretty darn easy as a candidate to just say, like, yeah, I took an oath and that guy didn't. I think there's a chance that, I mean, his voters are pretty enraged as they should be. So I think there's a chance that there's reform in that sense as well.
Yeah, there is this other question that I'm fascinated by, which is, it has something changed in our politics to allow for more George Santoses? And I think that there's some evidence that something has changed in the past few years. Because, you know, yes, there are people who've lied, you know, even including recently Republican J.R. Majewski lied about being deployed to Afghanistan, though he lost. Herschel Walker lied allegedly about paying multiple women's abortions, serving in the military, being an FBI agent. He also lost. You can go all the way back. Biden himself lied about his academic record in 88. He plagiarized speeches. He's, you know,
Elizabeth Warren famously called Pocahontas by Trump. Yeah.
Yeah. She also lied about where her kids went to school.
Yeah.
Something we've talked about here a lot. But I'm not a relativist. I don't think you are either. Like, I think, like, there is a difference between what he's doing and the sort of run-of-the-mill lies that we've seen, which are bad. And we've called out on this podcast, you know, I think one of our most watched TikTok videos ever was calling out Warren for the lie about where she sent her kids to school. Something has changed, though, recently. I was looking at just Trump and the Trump effect on lying. The Washington Post has Trump's false and misleading claims from his presidency at 30,573. And on November 2nd, just one day alone, the day before the 2020 vote, he made 503 false or misleading claims as he barnstormed the country to win re-election. If you look at his lies, they are varied. Some of them have to do with himself. Some of them have to do with other people. You remember he, like, famously in his lead up to running was talking about Obama's birth certificate and castigating Hawaiian officials and pushing all sorts of conspiracy theories about Hawaiian officials making up this birth certificate. He, you know, he lied about whether it rained on his inauguration day. We remember Sharpiegate about the Alabama Alabama hurricane. He lied about the trade deficit with China. He lied about payments to a porn star. Like, there's just like, he was lying about all sorts of things. And I looked at it and I'm like, well, we've called out Biden quite a bit on this podcast. You know, Washington Post looked at it first 100 days. They have Biden making 78 false or misleading claims in his first 700 days. Not great. But in Trump's first 100 days, he made 511. And obviously, the lies that he told on his way out were even more significant than on the way in. It just came out this week, for example, that he wanted to trademark rigged election, even as it came out in the January 6th committee that he had told Mark Milley from the Joint Chiefs of Staff that he knew he lost. So he was trademarking and marketing a stolen election, which had all sorts of devastating consequences on our country, while he lost. So if I'm George Santos, I'm looking at this, and Marjorie Taylor Greene, obviously, space lasers, all sorts of crazy stuff she's pushed, crisis actors. He's saying, all right, who's going to hold me accountable for this? And he might be right. Nobody.
I struggle to like take the one-to-one on this specific case. Like, I do think more outlandish claims like the space lasers stuff, like there's probably a pretty clean line you can draw from like Trump normalizing some more conspiratorial thoughts. But this guy, like the degree and like the depth of this and the fact that he's been saying a lot of these lies for years on end, like this seems like a pathological thing to me. Like this is someone that is just like I don't even know like whether it was Trump or not in his private life, he's probably going to be doing something like this. To me, I think where the lack of accountability really is the fact that local journalism is dying and nobody's on the national stage really cares about what's happening in one congressional district. And so things like this can kind of go under the radar. And even when there is a local paper that's like hollering about this and saying like this guy is a fraud, nobody even really listens to them because we've kind of flattened our media sphere. And so I think that this, to me, I think this is a really good case for why like having the journalists on the ground doing the stuff that maybe doesn't get all the clicks or all the ad revenue or all the papers sold is so important. And the fact that we have that resource in our country holding people on the local level accountable that's kind of withering away is allowing for situations like this to go by. Like, it's just shocking how thin his story was and how none of us even really, I mean, I hadn't heard of this guy before I heard that he was Jewish. And like, it's just, it's a sad reflection on the fact that we don't have those kind of localized checks and balances in place to hold people accountable.
There's more George Santoses out there in common life than people realize. Obviously, we've all watched, not all of us, but we've talked about at various points, the Tinder Swindler types and all this kind of stuff on Netflix. Yeah. Like, there are tons of bad actors out there. And then there are the, you know, run-of-the-mill people who just tend to exaggerate or a little fib here and there. There was a 2022 survey from Standout CV, which found that 55% of Americans have lied on their resume at least once.
And they admit like, as much, too.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's crazy.
And so most people are lying about their previous work experience or skills. 41% are lying about their college degree and 39% high school details. So this is real, and it's something that I think people are vulnerable to. As somebody who's employed a lot of people over my life, it's rare, actually, that people call you for a reference check when they're hiring the next employee, right? Like, so like if somebody leaves Lost Debate, it is much more likely that they'll be hired without somebody calling me and doing a reference check than they will. I think there are a lot of unseasoned hiring professionals out there. And I think like people are getting hoodwinked. And I think people applying for jobs are realizing they can get away with this kind of stuff. And it's the majority of people, which is kind of scary.
That is super scary. I mean, it's one thing to be like, oh, I'm very proficient in Excel, and like maybe that's not the case. But to lie about a degree is just shocking to me. That statistic is staggering. But I think Santos kind of takes the cake for the most bizarre, convoluted, endless list of complete falsehoods. And the fact that he's still like tweeting about how excited he is to serve his constituency, like, I mean, it's just, it's shocking, but you know, welcome to 2023.
Yeah. It is worth mentioning though, that this is just gets to, like, we've talked about the Supreme Court not really having any true ethics oversight. Congress is very similar here. In most situations, any situation, actually, you can imagine in American life, the average American is looking at this and be like, this person would be fired. Right. So it's, I think it's it adds to a frustration that the American people have. Yeah. I mean, there's whole TV shows based on this theory. For instance, Industry, a really awesome show on HBO. It's premised, and I'm not giving anything away because it's in the first episode, of a girl who goes to work for a big Goldman Sachs-like institution and lies about having attended Binghamton University, which is where I graduated from. Or she lied about having graduated from Binghamton. Mm-hmm. And so, like, and that's the whole thing, is she's trying to evade her employers, and she falsifies her records, et cetera. So, you know, Americans look at this, and I think they understandably are like, all right, one set of rules for you and different set of rules for the rest of us. It gets to the stock picking stuff that's happened in Congress and all that. It just adds to the impression, which seems to be a reality, that Congress is playing by a different set of rules.
So let's talk about a recent article that was published in The Atlantic in late December by Jerusalem Demsas, who wrote this article with a very provocative title called "The Home Ownership Society Was a Mistake," and the subheading, "Real Estate Should Be Treated as Consumption, Not Investment," basically arguing against the American dream sort of picket fence ideal of building up when you're young, renting, building up to finally owning a home and building equity, and that being a major investment and store of wealth for typical American people. And so she takes pretty fundamental issue with that line of argument. And I probably take a little bit of an issue with hers as well. But I think, yeah, what was your read on this article?
I think she makes some really good points. And then I think she makes some provocative points that I don't agree with, but that make you think, right? So I think it definitely adds a lot to the public debate around housing. And to summarize a couple points that she makes for the audience, one point, she kind of does a tour de force of the various elements of housing policy, going all the way back to redlining and racial disparities in the New Deal, in the post-New Deal world. But focusing on the present for a second, she first says, like, hey, it might be a mistake to concentrate your wealth on a single asset, and the more wealth you have, the smaller percentage of your wealth is typically in a home. So she says that the bottom 50% of the country is storing most of their wealth in their homes, so they're not diversified. So they're particularly vulnerable to fluctuations in the ebbs and flows of real estate. And there's a lot of evidence that, I know in recent times we've seen historic rises in values of property, but historically, actually, the stock market outpaces the value of real estate in this country if you go back to 1900. So from mm-hmm. today going back to 1900. So like it actually, like if you free up more money to invest in other places, you could be making more money. She also talks about how people tend to underrate the hidden costs of owning a home, including property taxes, utilities, maintenance costs, and upkeep. This is a point that a lot of people have been making over the years. Ramit Sethi, who is pretty, I think, a pretty interesting financial advice type guy. He's been talking about this for a while. Let's hear what he's had to say. I think this was like 10 years ago he's talking about this, but he's written mm-hmm. about this in a book since.
In certain parts of the country, it makes perfect sense to buy because the cost of renting is virtually the same as buying. You might as well just buy so you can build up equity. Yet here's the problem with the American sense of home ownership is that everyone should have a house. All right. So I have friends that graduate from college at age 21, and the first thing they want to do is buy a house. Without a 401k, give me a break. All right. Especially in areas like New York, San Francisco, some of these areas, it actually financially does not make sense to buy. Here's why. And listen closely. A lot of people think, oh, my rent is $1,000, so I can afford $1,000 for my mortgage. Wrong. What you have to add about 40 to 50% of your mortgage to account for all the phantom costs when it comes to buying a house. That would include taxes, maintenance, insurance, all kinds of stuff that you do not pay when you're renting.
So he's like, he's being a little advicey. His book, it's just kind of a cheesy title called, I think it's like, I'm going to make you rich or something like that. It's actually a really, really good book on financial advice. But Ricky, you've gone through this now in the very city he mentions in New York City,
yeah.
buying a house. What do you make of his argument that renting may be the better way to go?
So I would say, I think this is, it's true that like, yes, $1,000 doesn't translate exactly and there are additional costs, but he's not taking into account that $1,000 rented is $1,000 you never see back. $1,000 paid towards a mortgage, some of that is going to principal, some of that is going to interest, so you will see some of that back at one point in time. There are tax incentives. You're not like you pay post-tax all of your rent. You pay pre-tax some portions of your taxes and fees that go into your monthly payment as a homeowner. And so I think like it's not true that it's a one-to-one, and there are trade-offs, and I would say it's like super specific and super different person to person, especially super different depending on when you get your mortgage. Like I would not give the same advice to a friend who asked me today as I would have just a few months ago when the mortgage rates were so drastically different. I think there's truth in the fact that like one of the arguments that's in this Atlantic piece that I do think is solid is the fact that the mortgage system kind of obscures the entire market of housing, and it makes people buy in at subprime times at some point in time. I mean, it does kind of remind me of our conversation that we've had about student loans and how tuition is not really exposed to the free market of what people can actually afford.
Yeah.
Because there's somebody in between saying, oh, well, you can't afford this now, but you can in the future. And I think that to a certain degree, the mortgage system allows for home prices to rise just because people who can't afford something can afford something in a way that they like the free market would work that out in a different sense. But I think there's something really like lacking in this argument about just like what a mortgage payment consists of versus what renting consists of and where your money ends up going.
I think for most people, you have to run the model, and people are terrible at this. And real estate agents have a vested interest in making the model say, often what happens is the real estate agent will be like, hey, let me send you a spreadsheet to tell you what your costs are going to be in. And they're going to be trying to make it as, you know, palatable as possible for you to purchase. And what you need to do is you need to go and you need to compare the unrecoverable costs of renting, which is everything you pay to rent,
everything,
because you don't recover anything, with the unrecoverable costs of owning. And when you talk about, as you're talking about, the unrecoverable costs of owning are the property taxes, the maintenance costs, the costs of capital, which are very complicated. You have to factor in the fact that you could deduct the interest from your
payments.
Mortgage. The closing costs are unrecoverable. And then you have to factor in the opportunity costs, right? Like typically what's going to happen is the mortgage is going to probably be, and all those costs of owning are going to be more than renting, but some of that's going to go into investing in the asset itself, and part of it's going to be in the tax savings. So you have to compare all that to what you would anticipate you'd make in the market with the money that you'd save from that, and also compare it to other things like flexibility of renting versus the permanence of owning and all that. So, and also the fact that you could then borrow against your assets on your house, but then again, you could borrow against cash or other assets you have in the equity market. So it's very complicated. People need to run models on this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But it is an interesting point that she makes. One thing you said that I want to just double down on is that so much involves luck when it comes to the housing market. Did you decide to buy a year and a half ago versus today? Did you buy in the 70s versus today? Were you born at the right time, et cetera? Now, that's not unique to housing. There's luck everywhere in our financial system, including in the equities markets, including where you're born and what neighborhood you live in and what schools you go to. But it is really a roll of the dice for a lot of people. Like you and I are good examples of this. Like if we bought 2 years ago when it was 0% interest versus buying today, that's like everything. That's the ball game right there on the price of a house.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much to this argument that just leaves me unsatisfied though. Like the whole thing is like, home ownership is not as great as we think it is, which it's true. Like there's a lot of issues that are involved. There's a lot of inequity that's involved. But then like the very last few paragraphs is like, oh, and by the way, the rental market's kind of bad too. And like, maybe here are all the ways that we can fix the rental market. And like, to me, that's not like, it's just leaving us with no good options because the rental market also sucks. And when you're a renter, you're paying somebody else's mortgage more likely than not, and not building any equity. And so, you know, like a quote that I pulled that I found especially frustrating was, no one expects their TV or their car to be a store of value, let alone to appreciate. But I mean, a home is a home is a home. And like, a place to live will always be like, yes, you'll need to renovate to appreciate the cost at some point in time or fix something. But like, A car from X year is going to be an out of date model. A TV from X year is going to be out innovated, or people won't even be using TVs. I think there's something very particular to the fact that for all of developed human history, people have created homes and needed homes and will continue to need homes, that is an asset that at the very least you're fulfilling a very fundamental basic necessity for life when you're paying into it. And even if it is true that people in lower income brackets have a larger proportion of their wealth stored in their home, but that's just a fundamental necessity. And the fact that the top 1% has, like, they can take care of that necessity and then go above and beyond and invest everywhere else, yes, that is better. But I think rather than just like literally burning your money every single month, if you do have the time, the place, the situation, the mortgage rate, the cash saved up, like if buying a house makes sense for someone, I think saying like, no, this whole thing is just a fundamental mistake, but oh, by the way, also the rental market is super screwed up, is not really a productive conversation, personally, in my opinion.
She does make a fascinating argument, though, that we've made on this podcast. We also interviewed Connor Doherty for the New York Times about this, which essentially is saying part of the issue here is that there's a contradiction at the heart of the way our political system treats home ownership. And she quotes Joe Biden, who was trumpeting the fact that home values are going up, at the very same time that he's denigrating inflation everywhere else and talking about how it's a national crisis. Well, home values going up is part of inflation. So it's like, and yeah, at the same time that they're increasing interest rates, as we talked about, which is another form of inflation for people trying to enter the market. And so, and then she has this survey data from 2018, America's Mayors, in which she asked people about whether they had serious concerns about housing affordability. And less than 25% of mayors said it would be better if housing prices in my city declined. So mayors are saying they want home prices to go up. They want inflation in the housing market in their cities. Why? Because homeowners are some of the most powerful people politically in any given city. And we have this contradiction, which is we don't want people's, like, often these are people's retirements. Like, that's true of my mother. We don't want that to go down. And we're choosing that world over the world where people trying to enter the market, young people, are being priced out. And you're seeing in a lot of states, like, supply isn't going up. Home ownership rates are going down in a lot of critical places, mm-hmm. like New York and California. And, you know, these are some of the bluest states that are supposed to be, you know, talking about equity and accessibility and affordability, and are doing a terrible job, as we've talked about 100 times on this podcast. So she's right about that, I think. And everybody you talk to, whether it's Matthew Iglesias or Kenneth Jackson or Brookings Institution, conservative, Democrat, everybody seems to acknowledge that supply is a major issue, but not enough is being done.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of tension here between, like, we have these rent stabilization programs that end up making everything else more expensive, or like a lot of the regulations that we've tried to do have made things worse, or zoning laws that are blatantly preventing the construction of very in-demand housing. But like, it's definitely true that there's a, like, kind of pulling the ladder up with you sense of home ownership, yes, where you want to buy in, you want to get in at the right moment, because of course, why wouldn't somebody want to do that? But then you benefit from other people not being able to do the same. And I do agree that that is, like, fundamentally broken. And I think that there is a huge issue with the mortgage system and the idea that, like, just completely beyond your own control when you come of age, when you've acquired enough to do a down payment. Like, if the mortgage rate sucks for 30 years, you could be locked into something where your money is not doing, I mean, my money is doing so much more work for me than it would if I had signed and gotten a mortgage a couple months later. And so I think, like, there is something truly broken about the system, but I think the rental market is still broken. I think there's still reason to build equity. You can always sell, you can always refinance your mortgage if the time is right, if the situation is right for you. Of course, there are advantages to renting. I just think that to say that this whole system and the whole ideal of owning property, I mean, that is kind of like a fundamental bedrock of American civilization, and the idea that, like, you have land and property and something that's yours. And I don't know, just I'm not convinced it was a mistake. I think that a lot of mistakes have been made in home ownership society, but I don't think home ownership society as itself should be treated as a mistake.
Yeah, she does. I think at various points she hedges and says, hey, I'm not saying it's a mistake for everybody. But then there are other parts of the article that seem to go to be more forceful and saying, let's not make this an investment. Let's just treat it as a consumption good.
Yeah.
So obviously there's some contradictions in there. I think she's at her most persuasive when she talks about some of the racial gaps here. And she talks about a lot of this data going back to the pre-New Deal era, but especially New Deal era when they're creating, you know, the suburbanization of America, where they're creating towns like Levittown. And they explicitly back then excluded Black Americans mm-hmm. from this massive expansion of home ownership and wealth that happened at that point. And then you had redlining, where Black Americans weren't able to access homes in white neighborhoods. And you basically had the government and banks colluding to create more segregation, both within cities and in suburbs. And then they talk about data to this day. She quotes data from the Brookings Institution from 2018, a study that showed that when you basically control for things like school quality, access to businesses, crime, homes in majority Black neighborhoods are worth 23% less than a home in a neighborhood that doesn't have strong concentrations of Black Americans. So there are present effects of past discrimination. There may be present discrimination for sure. There are all sorts of studies about, like, if you're going into a realtor and you're Black, or you're going to a realtor and you're white, how do you get treated? The same studies have shown that when it comes to trying to buy a car, et cetera. But without a doubt, like, even if people are debating what the present effects are, acts of discrimination are, the effects are there. There is an inequality. Mm-hmm. It also gets to refinancing. You're talking about who refinances and who doesn't. It's proportionally lower for Black and Brown Americans. So she makes some good points, I think, on the equity front here as well, that I think are really worth exploring. And I'm not sure what the public policy answer is, but it does seem to be a problem.
Yeah, I would just really struggle to say that for somebody who's like 30, 40 years out from retirement age, if they're picking between renting or buying at that point in time, to say that you'd rather somebody see someone burn their money with the, you know, every year your mortgage or your rent can go up and your landlord can price you out, or you, like, you know, you don't have any guarantee. And I'd much rather see somebody for the next 30 years, if the situation makes sense for them, pay, even if there's a lot of interest, which is obviously really frustrating, pay in every month. And then by the time they're at retirement age, they own their home outright or something like that. Like, I think that, mm-hmm. like, the last thing, I think if we were to really marry the thesis of this article, we'd end up with a generation of people who are at retirement age who would need to show income in order to rent. Like, it's really worthwhile to have built that to fall back upon when you no longer want to work, or when you no longer can work for a period of time, or if you lose a job. Like, I think a lot of her points are right. I would imagine maybe somebody pushed her to make it a little more provocative, because I do think that there are places where she does kind of let up here and there, but that title, I just can't get, I can't get with it.
Well, there's one last piece. I'll just direct people to it in here, where she talks about an intergenerational Ponzi scheme. And she quotes a 2018 article from the City Observatory, which essentially says that we're transferring wealth from younger people to older people under some kind of promise that when young people become old, they'll be the new older people. And basically, like, these rising values of these houses are being passed on from one generation to the next. I don't fully follow the argument, but we'll direct people to that. We'll put that in the show notes. I found it provocative, but I didn't fully understand what she was saying there. Also worth noting that the name of the book that I was trying to reference earlier is I Will Teach You to Be Rich by Ramit Sethi. It's pretty good. It's all about, like, how to treat your personal finances. And there's this other book by Morgan Housel called The Psychology of Money, which is also really awesome, came out recently. And those are two of my favorite books on this kind of stuff, like just long-term financial planning. Mm-hmm. I think my biggest advice, not that this is an advice podcast, is you have to build a financial model based on the assumptions about your current financial situation, where you plan to spend your time, how much space you need. Are you planning to expand your family? Are you planning to stay the same size that you're in? And the relevant costs in your area, right? Like, closing costs, if you're buying a $1 million apartment in New York City, for example, your closing costs are gonna be like $80,000-$90,000, like, with everything in, taxes, closing costs, et cetera. That needs to be factored in, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're probably in Florida or Tennessee, it's gonna be a lot lower. So Like, obviously there's a nuance to this.
Or if you don't use a realtor and just use Street Easy like me, your closing costs go down quite a lot. But my closing advice is don't take any advice from me because I'm 22. So I'll let your closing advice stand.
Well, you know this about me. I'm a huge Buffalo person. They just recently were hit by just an amazing amount of snow, huge snowstorms, and it created an interesting dichotomy. Buffalo itself, which was seeing as much as 6 feet of snow, shifted to remote learning instead of having traditional snow days, while the neighboring Niagara Falls district canceled school like we used to do back in the day and had traditional snow days. And this seems to be part of a bit of a split that's happening in America right now. There's this great article in the 74 by Nathan Sorber titled, "Is Remote Learning Burying Snow Days? It Depends on Where You Live." Essentially, what Nathan is saying is the pandemic definitely led to an increase in districts and states cutting traditional snow days, but there are still plenty of places in America where you're still having that traditional snow day. There's a lot of data to jump into here, but before we even get there, should we keep traditional snow days or should we go remote on days when it snows?
Yes, absolutely, we should. But I think that school districts should
keep
budget
traditional
in.
Snow days?
Keep them. Keep, yeah, 100%. Like, I think if you go beyond a certain number, like, I do remember growing up, there'd be random years in New Jersey where, like, it would snow a ton, and then you'd be behind and make up years or make up days at the end of the year. So I would be in favor of doing remote learning if you've hit a certain threshold. But I think snow days are like fundamental to being a kid. I don't know. I can't recall too many rosy memories from actually being in class, but I can probably remember some detail of like almost every snow day growing up. I loved it. I lived for that. My best friend, I'd call her and she'd come over and we'd sled. It was awesome. Can't lose that.
I am of two minds of this. I was a former school principal and famously did not cancel a lot of school in Nashville. Now, it didn't snow in Nashville, but they would cancel for rain sometimes. And if it even dusted the road, they'd cancel it. Now, part of me looked at that and didn't respect it as a snow day because my rule for a true snow day is, could you go outside and play tackle football with your friends or sled? If you can't do that, I don't really treat it as a snow day. But what I learned over time was actually southern cities, when it snows, are incredibly unsafe. So I actually started to cancel school more and more often. That was before we had good remote learning. I think with this remote learning, I'd probably keep kids in school more. But I agree, where it does snow a lot, it is a rite of passage as a child, especially that first snow day. It's I think just fun can be an end of itself, and giving kids that experience, it's almost like a holiday in America. Like if you live
and
in a snowy area.
And kids actually go outside. Like that's the one time that you actually see kids outside. And we've talked about social media and like addiction and all that terrible stuff. Like this is the one moment where kids are kids, and I think, I don't know, just make it a last resort to do remote learning. And I think this also, and a really important question, is power outages too. Because if you don't have power, or if only certain people have power, or only certain people can afford a generator, like if you're going to have a snow day, if a snow day is severe enough, I mean, you do need to realize that remote learning is not always a possibility, or for kids who don't have access to adequate internet and in their home. I mean, I do think that like there is a question of equity too that comes from this question as well, especially in areas that either are not prepared for snow and the power lines are not prepared, or in areas where the snow is so severe that people do lose power, which happened almost every single time, like living in a rural area of New Jersey, every single time that we'd have a snow day, the power would go out.
Well, just to layer on some data here, it is important to note that research in Colorado, Maryland, Virginia showed that each additional inch of snow led to less continuity of learning, which in turn made it less likely that elementary school students would pass math assessments. So there is a loss of learning that's worth taking into account. So there needs to be a balance. This article also talks about just where the snow day continues to exist and where it doesn't. They talked about how nearly 40% of schools chose to forego traditional snow days during the heart of the pandemic, and they collected data from 35 states that suggest that there's just a mixed bag out there right now. So even before the pandemic, certain states were starting to adapt to the new technology. So Minnesota authorized 5 e-learning days a year. Illinois followed suit in 2019. In Pennsylvania, 85% of public school districts can take advantage of a 2019 policy that allows 5 days of remote instruction. So that's all before the pandemic.
Yeah.
Then in 2022, very notably, New York's Board of Regents authorized the states to teach remotely instead of canceling class. That's what Buffalo took advantage of there. And New York announced basically that the snow day is gone under David Banks. Maryland now allows up to 8 days a year of remote learning, so long as five of those include live sessions with a teacher, and Virginia's law allows 10 days. Baltimore seems to have a mix, which I think is what I would do, which is they have five makeup days in the calendar. Once those days are exhausted by snow days, then you start going remote. I like that because it's saying, hey, you get your five snow days, but
agreed.
After that, we're doing remote learning.
That seems fair because I do understand the continuity of learning argument. But I would say, like, I don't know, there's something a little cruel to me. Like the New York City school chancellor said, sorry, kids, no more snow days, but it's going to be good for you. Like, I don't know. You need to have a little more of a holistic approach to what is good for kids, though. Like, yes, education is enormously important. But sometimes, like, being a New York City kid who's pent up all the time and all of a sudden you can go outside and it's snowing and, like, maybe get yourself down to Central Park or to, like, or Prospect Park or something. I don't know. That is a different form of good for you, too. And I think totally nixing it is a mistake. I'm pro snow day. I'm pro if you want to make like a pre-made packet, which I know some states are doing, say, here's some work to do, like figure it out at some point in time before you show back up to school. That's fine.
I do want to note, though, as somebody who used to create these packets, that they're kind of bullshit. Like, nobody really reads them. They're so unevenly completed, and there's sometimes parents involved, some aren't. It's like an extension of the problem with homework, you know, where homework has all sorts of issues too around reliability, even though we would assign homework. The remote stuff, I think, helps a lot of this. Obviously, like, a lot of districts had to get used to this. My sense is that we're going to see like a 50% reduction or something in snow days moving forward, but they don't completely go away.
Yeah, I think the Baltimore systems, I would imagine, is what more areas than not are going to decide on. I don't know.
My favorite thing is just it's the adults who got more upset with me than the kids when you brought them back to school. Often it depends on the population of kids. Mm. The kids that I served often wanted to get back to school. Maybe after one day they would want to be home, but then they would be like, all right, I'm excited to go to school. So I think it often depends. And, you know, you got to think about, like, in high school, for example, there are a lot of clubs, there's a lot of sports and stuff like that. And, like, you want to get things open back up again. Obviously, remote instruction isn't going to solve that, but I do think there's a sense of urgency. And I think often the debate around reopening schools is obscured and it's dominated by the people who are the adults acting as if they're in the best interest of kids. Like, oh, yeah, like, have the kids fun. But I'm like, all right, it's day five of snow days now. We can clear the roads. Let's get these kids back in school.
You know? Yeah, as soon as possible. But let them have their fun while they can. I don't know. Don't make kids look outside at the snow coming down and staring at a Zoom screen. That doesn't even, like, remote learning is not as effective as we make it out to be in the first place.
My sense is, though, day five, they're in their video games inside. They're
That's
not outside
true.
Playing tackle
That's
football
That's true.
Hey, this is Ricky. You've reached The Lost Debate. If you have some feedback for us, leave it after the tone.
Well, Ricky, one last fun voicemail that I'm forcing you to listen to is from one of our lovely listeners. Let's cut to it, and we'll see what you have to say about this.
Yeah, my name's Adam, calling from Southwest Michigan. I think I've listened to every single episode, which is why I feel like I'm qualified to say that I think Ricky needs to eat more crow regarding her admiration of Elon Musk. I feel like as your guys' Elon or Twitter episodes have gone on, or other topics involving Elon, she's always come to his defense. She's praised him. She has the Elon shirt. And I think he's really exposed himself as someone who is qualified no more than anyone else except for making a few suave business moves, accumulating massive amounts of wealth, largely thanks to government programs like green energy credits for Tesla, or SpaceX getting money from the government. Anyways, and you've watched him kind of unravel this Twitter deal and just be absolutely awful at it. And I just feel like Ricky hasn't owned up enough to how much Elon has failed and how much he's kind of fallen back down to earth. And I feel like she owes that to us. Anyways, keep up the good work. Love the show. Thank you.
Adam, thank you so much.
Adam.
Yeah.
Yeah.
First of all, listen to all our episodes. So very respectful.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to apologize for my optimism because I think I went back, I listened to what we said in our last segment. I will read a few quotes from myself.
Oh, God.
Definitely that's a step too far in response to what he did in censoring journalists. Said it's definitely not a good look all around. I said, I don't have a defense against this because he's gone back on his prior word. I will stand by that. I am not into what has transpired, but I will not apologize for being optimistic because as a free speech advocate, there are very few times where it seems like maybe we'll have a champion kind of coming for us and doing what we were hoping they might do. But it did not, so far it's not been awesome, I admit, but I was optimistic. I was, for once, I was optimistic. So I'm not going to apologize. I won't wear the Elon shirt.
I appreciate so much what Adam said. The one thing I would take issue with is his previous success. I do think that what he did with Tesla and SpaceX was nothing short of remarkable and a true testament to his tenacity, genius, and risk-taking that I think should be rewarded. You know, if you just look at, for example, what he did with rockets and designing his own rockets and, you know, going to, there's like a famous story where he went to Russia, he was trying to buy rockets, and then he basically started designing his own on his way back. He was scrappy. And in contrast to a lot of other entrepreneurs, he wasn't creating like, you know, pets.com. He was trying to solve really big things. There was a really good Pivot episode last week where Kara Swisher talks about, because she's interviewed Elon Musk more than anybody else, the shift that's happened from Elon Musk. And she, until recently, was a huge champion of his and even wrote the Time 100 blurb about him and then talks about how something changed. But what she says, it's something I agree with, is that there was a version of him that was quite remarkable and that he's kind of lost his focus. And honestly, he's become part of the ADD generation now. He's lost himself quite a bit in the very company that he's bought. What I do agree with, though, is you eating crow on this, which I really appreciate. I've been thinking about this. When we did that segment, there was something I noticed afterwards, which is when we talk about Twitter, there's a difference. Like, you were talking about Elon and you're like, you were talking about his motivations, and sometimes motivations are pure, but then we talk about Twitter and I'm defending their motivations, right? I'm being like, look, they were worried about Russian interference, right? And so I think when you and I are talking about these two, and I'll put myself in the same boat as you, I think you and I are more likely to point to pure motivations and bad outcomes with people that we're a little bit sympathetic to, which in the case of Twitter, I was sympathetic to their how they took Russian interference seriously. And so I was willing to think about their motivations more than the outcome there. And I suspect you were doing that with Elon.
I'm just trying to steel man it for my guy. What can I say? No, I'm kidding. But I did not wear the Elon shirt on our last episode, and I think that was by design. So take it as you will. I'll wear my Biden shirt the next time to make up for it. I do own one. So.
Oh my God. Well, okay, yeah. I'm actually working on something where I'm trying to like sketch out how do you treat the Elon Musk type people of the world, and I'm basically arguing that you want to use a litmus test that you would use to anybody in your life. Are they being honest? Are they being consistent? Are they learning from their mistakes? Are they humble? Or do you have any sense of their motivations, and are those motivations pure? Are they attempting to grow? Why do you care, right? Like, there are so many people in this public square that you may or may not care about, right? And I think like the question is, why do we care about Elon versus other people? I'll make the case that we probably do care about Elon Musk given how important and powerful he is. But I'm attempting to like just make it relatable and say, all right, this is common sense. Like, people are so, I think, blinded by the teams that they're in that they don't look at it and say, all right, is this the kind of behavior I would accept from anybody in my life? And I think the answer is often no. And that doesn't mean it's a death sentence for somebody in the public square. Like, because where I depart from Adam is like, I do think Elon is a talented guy who I am rooting for. I just don't root for him when he acts like an ass, like he's been acting the past few months, if not maybe the better part of the past 2 years. But that doesn't mean like I don't open the door as a as a fan of some things that he's done to be more sympathetic to him in the future.
Yeah, I think he can definitely do better. I will admit that much. But I'm, you know, any free speech champion is just like, at least just stick by that one for me. But so far, it's not been the best track record, I do admit.
Well, we are at the end of this episode, and I want to thank our listeners. It's exciting to start a new year with you. Please send us voicemails, as you can tell. We listen to them. We've got a bunch of them over the break, and we're wading through them right now. Our voicemail is 321-200-0570. Once again, we are back with a regular schedule, which means we'll have an episode on Thursday. Once again, also, you can go to the Citizen Stewart Show and hear us talking about education, as we do every Tuesday over there. Thank you very much. Talk to you Thursday.
Lost Debate is the flagship show of the Lost Debate Network. Our executive producer is Michael Hendricks, research support by Joe Garvey and Ariane Misra, studio support and video editing by Moyo Adeolu, editing and sound design by Joe Engelbrecht and Monica Espedia.